Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have a rare treat, not rare in the sense that this guest is unfamiliar or not, in fact, a regular here at Securing America, but rare in the sense that it's not every day that even a guy as prolific as Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, comes out with a new book. And this is one of those days. It's entitled War Against the Deep State, the subtitle of which is Origins of the Mass Surveillance State and the Three Unlawful Branches of the Government. John Mills, congratulations on this important new work, and thanks for your service over a lifetime of really important contributions, initially in the United States Army, and then after you took off the uniform as a colonel, you served in the civilian side of the Office of the Secretary of Defense, working on, among other things, cyber warfare and related topics. You are these days, I'm proud to say, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and a very active contributor to the public policy debate with The Nation Will Follow, your previous book, and now The Deep State. It's good to have you with us, sir, and welcome.
Oh, thank you, Frank. It's quite an honor to be on with you. And I thought this was an important story to tell of the establishment of the surveillance state and the unlawful fourth, fifth, and sixth branches of government, the fourth being the administrative state, the fifth being the fusion of the marriage of federal law enforcement, intelligence, and big tech, and then the sixth being nonprofits. And those have all been weaponized against the American people.
We are going to drill down on all of those. Thank you for giving us an hour of your time to do that, John. And I guess I'd like to start with just defining some terms. Deep state is one of those that has become, I guess, familiar to many of us. Donald Trump, among others, talks about it quite a bit. And yet it's not always entirely clear what's meant by it. Are the three branches of the government, the unlawful branches that you've just described, all part of that deep state or surveillance state, or are they adjuncts that work with it?
Well, the three have evolved and developed. The fourth one, the administrative state, there's somewhat of a legal basis, and that's the 1946 Administrative Procedures Act, but that grew into the out-of-control EPA, which has been struck down twice in federal Supreme Court rulings, both on groundwater and coal emissions. But there was an inkling of a legal start to that. The marriage of big tech along with federal law enforcement and federal intelligence a little more murky. Now, I was really in a lot of ways part of this, but as I reflected, I tried to figure out what were some of the how did this happen? How did this happen? And that's what I go through in the book. The nonprofits are, in one way, the most nefarious. There is a legal basis, a 501c3 in the IRS. I'm all for nonprofits, but they've really become, there's little oversight. And although they're supposed to be nonpartisan, that is just by Tony Blinken, the greatest election interference ever was conducted straight out of the UPenn Biden Center, which we still can't find.
A so-called C3. Well, again, John, we're going to get into all of this in a little bit more detail, and it's a luxury to have the time to do that. But again, just in terms of understanding the deep state, would you say that all of these are elements of it operating to varying degrees collusively and unlawfully, at least in part, and therefore that much more dangerous to a constitutional republic like ours.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. They've incrementally developed. They haven't been challenged, and they continue to grow.
Well, when you say they haven't been challenged, I think clearly Donald Trump would say, no, no, I tried to challenge it,
yes,
but he was unsuccessful. And I want you to lay out a little bit of your own personal history here, John, because I think it's instructive, both in terms of your insights, but also you lived through some of that experience where a president, a duly elected president of the United States, was trying to rein in or control or otherwise, you know, check these entities that were working, among other things, to destroy his administration and arguably the country as well, no?
Well, right. I was one of the senior Department of Defense leads for what was known as the Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative that ran from 2007 to 2014. And that really is where the surveillance state really was established. The pervasive surveillance state with capabilities that were just breathtaking. And it was all started with, for good reasons and good purposes. It was supposed to protect Americans from the foreign extremist threat. But once it was established, it was very easily turned around and directed at the American people. So that's where I was involved, and I realized something had really gone wrong.
Yeah. John, this is something that is often said, and I don't know whether you would agree with it or not, but that actually it all began with the Patriot Act earlier in that decade, that the powers that were given, the upshot of it in part being the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, intrusive capabilities to monitor, as you say, initially foreign entities or their outcrops here. Do you date it from that or 6 years later?
No, I think that's a good observation and a good point is it's always the unintended consequences of legislation. And that really set the ball rolling in that direction of a mass surveillance state. Yeah, we wouldn't have had the CNCI program without the Patriot Act. And in 2003, there was the strategy for cyberspace released by the Bush administration. Admiral McConnell, who I later worked for, was one of the key authors of that strategy document, which really, I think you could many ways point at that derived from the Patriot Act also. And that was the executive branch. That was the executive branch strategy to establish dominance in the evolving area of cyberspace. So absolutely, the Patriot Act was important, and all these things happen step by step, incrementally, and a lot of times it isn't dramatic change. But then you all of a sudden you look back, and say, "Wow! If you look back, we've changed dramatically since that time." But it was all incrementally over time.
Right. John, we have to take a break shortly. Let me just tee up where I'd like to go next with you. The administrative state as an instrument for making effectively laws without going through Congress has been, as you indicated, something that has been addressed repeatedly by the Supreme Court, but unchecked largely as we speak. And arguably is getting worse by the day. I want to talk to you about how that is and what do we do about it right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
Kevin McCarthy is no longer Speaker because at the end of the day, a majority of the House of Representatives no longer trusted him. If integrity becomes a job requirement going forward, it will serve the Congress and the nation well. The same must apply to the leadership of the U.S. military. In a powerful essay at LifeSiteNews.com and a devastating new book entitled Defending the Constitution Behind Enemy Lines, serving Navy Commander Robert Greene courageously observes that, quote, there is no more important value to building an effective fighting force than trust, unquote. Particularly devastating to such trust has been uniformed leaders' misconduct in successive wars, the disastrous surrender of Afghanistan, and illegally compelling service personnel to be jabbed with unapproved so-called vaccines. The Senate must reject, not reward, senior officers nominated for promotion but who have, like Speaker McCarthy, proven untrustworthy. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, and the author most recently of The Deep State, subtitled Origins of the Mass Surveillance State and the Three Unlawful Branches of Government, a tale told from his firsthand experience in the belly of the beast, much of it either in uniform or as a civilian in the years since the Patriot Act was adopted. And John, true confession, I was among the supporters of the Patriot Act at the time. I felt very strongly that the nature of particularly the jihadist enemy that we were confronted might require some infringements on our personal freedoms, but that they were both limited in scale and necessary under the circumstances. And what you've described, John, briefly, was in the last block, how this morphed incrementally over time. Talk a little bit about this phenomenon of the administrative state being responsible for effectively rewriting the laws, not just implementing them, but also adjusting them, changing them, fundamentally altering them in some cases. And how much that has contributed to the problem that you're talking about with the deep state.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Yeah, we have a law. It's called the 1946 Administrative Procedures Act. When a law is given to the president for enactment, that's when a president signs a law agreed upon by both sides of Congress. Okay, that is the law. But that isn't necessarily effective, that doesn't effectively flow into necessarily U.S. code or into regulation. And the 1946 APA describes a process for taking a law and how do you translate that into effective regulation. And you may have to do something called the rulemaking. You have to go through the public comment process. And that's where the language is really transformed into effective regulation. And I think the best known for abuse and the poster child for this has been the EPA, which we American citizens have struggled with for years and has used this process to essentially make law. So in reverse, they're making law out of regulation and acting with these words as if they are the full force of law when they're really interpretation of law. And two good Supreme Court cases ruled against the EPA, very effective in 2022, was the groundwater situation and the coal emissions. So both were significant losses for the EPA, but the Biden administration is right at it again, trying to play this game and play an end around.
Yeah. And to the extent that it is doing that through not just the administrative state, but as you say, John, through arrangements that have emerged in terms of the law enforcement community, notably the FBI, now interacting very directly and on an ongoing basis with the intelligence community, something that there had been a wall separating them prior to the Patriot Act, and that was changed in light of the failure to understand between the domestic law enforcement and the intelligence community some of the threats that had been evidenced on 9/11. But then there's this other element, as you say, John, the big tech piece. Drill down a little bit on the macro problem as it is demonstrated in those sort of three elements of your fifth illegal branch of government.
Yeah, the marriage of law enforcement, intelligence, and big tech, it really, one of my jobs was to reestablish Department of Defense presence in Silicon Valley. That was starting really about 2007. So it was still during the Bush years. At that time, Google was still an up-and-comer. Wasn't anything dominant like it is today. Same with Facebook, same with Twitter, same with LinkedIn, same with all these. I mean, we were still a Microsoft society, but Microsoft is part of big tech. But so we started having different meetings. And then when it changed from the Bush to the Obama administration, we still had several iterations of visits and interaction and meetings. And clearly at first, big tech and Obama were kind of, they didn't really totally trust each other. But I think it was about 2010 where they saw a great compatibility with each other. And I think from that point on, it was an inseparable marriage, and that brought in federal law enforcement and intelligence, especially...
This is basically the old line about the enemy of my enemy is my friend, bringing them together in a marriage of convenience, I guess one would say. And how did it actually operate, John? I guess the Twitter files that Elon Musk has released gave us some insights into that, but describe it in practice, if you would.
Well, and I have a federal filing that I'm literally reviewing the final draft here from my lawyers, because I'm a party to this to these Twitter files. This is something I've really wondered myself. And I think it was two things that really got them out of control. It was the 2013 update to the Smith-Moot Act, the Smith-Moot Modernization Act, which was an obscure Cold War era law that American-produced information, some would just automatically label it propaganda. I think it's a little unfair. Because that was our way in which we told our side of the story during the Cold War. But Smith-Moot said, you can't use that information. You can't even project it to the American people. That was totally forbidden. The Smith-Moot Modernization Act, you'd have to read it a number of times, but this is where it appears that was the first, and that was a very strongly bipartisan supported piece of legislation, but the Modernization Act said you can now take that product and just like cyber, just like big data collection, you can now turn that around and face it at the American people. And at the time, I was aware of that. That wasn't a piece of legislation that I was responsible for, but I was aware of it. And at the time, sounded okay, like the Patriot Act. Sounded okay, but that's when the train really was clearly off the rails at that time. And then I think you have to marry that up with the September 2018 executive order, which the FBI, and I've been in the White House and done executive orders. I've seen the process. I've had pen on several executive orders. in the White House and then many more outside of the White House. I think that's really where it became weaponized to question that narrative put out by the 2013 Smith-Moot Modernization Act. So one, in 2013, now you could point that information at the American people. And then in 2018, because of that executive order, it almost became, it criminalized it to even question that government narrative, which begat.
All right. Now, John Mills, this is a fascinating topic, especially in that that executive order would have been signed by President Trump, I believe. And we'll talk about how it is that came about and where it's left us to this day in terms of government manipulation of information and censorship of what we know. Stay tuned for more with John Mills, the author of The Deep State, right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we are visiting with the author of a brand new and very important book, The Deep State. It talks about three unlawful branches of government that are in addition to the ones that our Constitution created. That would be, of course, the Congress of the United States, the executive branch, and the judiciary. And our guest, Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, has said there is now a deep state that has sort of three unauthorized branches operating, and those would be, well, first and foremost, a whole host of capabilities in the administrative state that have created legislative authorities, in effect, and the convergence of the law enforcement, the intelligence, and the big tech entities on information control and disinformation censorship, as it's called. And then not least, a whole array of completely non-governmental entities, in fact, nonprofits. And we're going to get into more on all of those. But John, I wanted to start this part of the conversation with you by saying you've just indicted an executive order in 2018 that would have been promulgated, signed by Donald J. Trump, a man who has made no secret of his enmity towards the deep state and who suffered greatly at its hands, I think. So give us a little bit of the genealogy of this thing. How did it come about, and why is it that Donald Trump would have signed such a thing?
Well, I think it was bottom line trickery. I think it was those who knew what they really meant and didn't properly explain it to the chief of staff at the time, which might have been Kelly, General Kelly. But even Kelly was, does that mean Kelly was in on it? I don't know. I don't think so. But what that did is it set up the Foreign Influence Task Force, which that's at the FBI, and that's where Elvis Chan and Lisa. Oh, I apologize. I should know the other his supervisor's name. She's another one. That's another story. Demlo, I think it is. I think it was Laura Demlo. Maybe wrong in that, so I'll double check that. But that's where the task force was set up. I can't find legislation that created the Foreign Influence Task Force. But that really kind of weaponized, and it created this mythology inside the federal government that anybody who questioned, because remember, this was still Trump, Russia, had not been proven to be false at this time. So this was almost a trick to get Donald Trump from the beginning, but it really weaponized that any American who was questioning an election, obviously, was under the influence of foreign element, i.e. Russia, not China, Russia. But this is where the DHS and their mis, dis, and malinformation task force, which has never been explained, I think that's really, but an executive order presumes there's already clear, established law, establishing these activities and these groups, and that's where it's like, just like the administrative process, it's like, hold on a second here, we actually don't have law established. It's an executive order, but there's a bunch of leaps of faith. There's no legislation that identifies the Foreign Influence Task Force that I can find. There's no neither the Mis, Dis, Malinformation Task Force at DHS and also declaring election critical infrastructure. They probably point back to the executive order, but hold on a second, that's not law. That's an executive order which presumes law is in existence. But if you start continuing to peel the onion back, there's no law on these things.
Yeah, but this goes back to what we were talking about in the first block, is that essentially law-making authorities, maybe not called that, but in practice it amounts to it, has now migrated into essentially wholly unaccountable agencies, bureaucracies, if you will, deep state. John, you know, I have a theory of how some of this began, and your corporate memory is better and longer, I guess, than mine, perhaps. But I remember vividly that in the period after 9/11, there was an effort by a group that I believe was a very dangerous jihadist entity called the Muslim Brotherhood. And it migrated after the attacks, amazingly, through an interesting story too long to tell here, but that I've chronicled at length, into government. And from basically the first days began trying to persuade the Bush administration that we weren't dealing with jihadis, we weren't dealing with their so-called nonviolent counterparts in the Muslim Brotherhood. We were dealing with something called violent extremism that really had nothing to do with Islam or jihad or Sharia or the Muslim Brotherhood. And you know, once you got into that sort of mindset, then it just became a question of, so who is a violent extremist? And to your earlier point, I think it was pretty clear that they were going to call anybody that they didn't like violent extremists. And that led in turn to a lot of distortion and manipulation and other shenanigans with not just mal, dis, and misinformation, but even, John, intelligence and what we're told to believe based upon the intelligence community. And one of the things I'd like you to sort of tease out, because both the intelligence community and the FBI were involved in this, as was DHS, this fundamental transformation, if you will, under Barack Obama. But John, the the collapse of counterintelligence in the country at the moment, specifically as it's supposed to be practiced by the FBI, has become a persistent problem throughout all of this, has it not?
Well, yes. And a poster child, which has not gotten a whole lot of attention, is the arrest of Charles McGonigal, and who was one of the individuals that identified to the Durham investigation. He was the source of the information that was being peddled by senior FBI officials in interagency meetings that I was part of in early 2016. Charles McGonigal, this is explosive.
Indeed. We did talk about it the other day with Sam Faddis. Remind us who McGonigal is or was at the time.
He was the director of counterintelligence in the New York field office, the largest FBI field office in the world outside of headquarters. And this is like Jesus James Angleton said in the 60s and 70s, there's a spy, Jesus was wrong. There was four spies, but there was, this is just continuing that tradition. And McGonigal was the guy. He was arrested for taking money from the Russians. Now, initially it was said after he retired, and I said, I guarantee you these things always have tentacles going back to when he was in service, and now the story has changed. Now the charges include money received while he was in service, is my understanding. So yes.
Oh, I think so. And according to Sam, among the others he was working with were, wait for it, the Chinese Communist Party as well. It was not just the Russians. And all of that seems to have been deep sixed by such little reporting has been done on the case. But to the larger point, John, you've worked with these agencies at very high levels for a long time. It seems to me it's hard to overstate the problem of essentially the guys who have the charge of counterintelligence being essentially tasked with chasing down school board moms and people who, are opposed to abortion or other similar, otherwise patriotic Americans, as though those are the real threat to our country, not either foreign or domestic enemies of our country.
Yeah, this is just absolutely shameful that is what's going on. And we have more and more whistleblowers that are coming forward. We have several dozen out of the FBI now and who are being treated horribly, unlawfully in accordance with the Whistleblower Act. And I'm just shocked by it. I mean, taking their security clearances might be procedurally okay, but stopping their pay, I don't think that's allowable. So this is just crazy.
These are not consistent with the spirit that whistleblowers are to be protected and enabled to come forward and disclose wrongdoing of all kinds. John, we have to take another short break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit further about this element that you've described as the nonprofit unlawful branch of the government and how they're playing into these other elements to undermine our constitutional republic and the freedoms that it guarantees us. We'll be right back on that score and much more with John Mills, Colonel, United States Army retired, author of The Deep State. Thank you.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Kevin McCarthy is no longer Speaker because at the end of the day, a majority of the House of Representatives no longer trusted him. If integrity becomes a job requirement going forward, it will serve the Congress and the nation well. The same must apply to the leadership of the U.S. military. In a powerful essay at LifeSiteNews.com and a devastating new book entitled Defending the Constitution Behind Enemy Lines, serving Navy Commander Robert Green courageously observes that, quote, there is no more important value to building an effective fighting force than trust, unquote. Particularly devastating to such trust has been uniformed leaders' misconduct in successive wars, the disastrous surrender of Afghanistan, and illegally compelling service personnel to be jabbed with unapproved so-called vaccines. The Senate must reject, not reward, senior officers nominated for promotion but who have, like Speaker McCarthy, proven untrustworthy. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're spending this hour with John Mills, Colonel United States Army retired, a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, a senior fellow at our Center for Security Policy, and the author of a brand new book, The Deep State, which talks about how a surveillance state has sprung up, born of the excesses of the administrative state, the collusion between the FBI, the law enforcement community, the intelligence community, and big tech. And not least, and we're going to turn to it now, a sixth branch of government, an all-lawful branch of government, as he puts it, nonprofits. John, describe what you mean by nonprofits and the unique role they play in the Washington ecosystem. There are others elsewhere around the country, but many of them are here, including, I have to say, one I founded and long have run called the Center for Security Policy.
Well, so there's an established IRS rule on nonprofits that does trace to a law. And so there's a process you go through, a 501c3, okay, Center for Security Policy. I'm a senior fellow there, okay? I'm totally for nonprofits, but there's several basic rules. You're not supposed to be partisan, and you're supposed to be transparent. And I think that's there's challenges there, significant challenges where and there's maybe a third element is there's equal application of the nonprofits because we're conservative nonprofits being sat upon and slow rolled. Oh, yeah. No question about it.
Anything with Tea Party somewhere in the title, as I recall.
Yeah. It's been well documented. I have a couple of nonprofits and it took a little while to set those up. I always was curious about that. So all for nonprofits, not questioning the noble spirit of nonprofit, but clearly on the blue team, they really push the envelope and the guardrails of the regulation and the tax laws.
And when you say blue team, you mean Democratic-oriented nonprofits?
Yeah. I just think that is questionable. I think that one of the most recent poster childs is the UPenn Biden Center, which is where Tony Blinken essentially was the quarterback of the greatest election interference operation in history. He ran the 51 Intel officer letter, which we know at least one current CIA official facilitated and actively sought signatures. And I knew and worked with or worked for 11 of the 51. And I go, this is just absolutely outrageous. Why is an active duty CIA official actively soliciting? But I've been in so many meetings there becomes such a blurring of lines. And one time when I was at the White House, one of my colleagues was enmeshed in this activist group that had come in and wanted to petition the White House. And I had to pull them aside and said, hold it, you're an active duty government civilian. You can't be in this group of wanting to advocate. It goes, well, yeah, but I'm on leave and I want to. I go, no, you can't do that. And I asked him to leave. But this is the crazy. It wasn't a very serious matter, but still, it just shows the craziness that goes on. And
can I share a story on that yeah, sort of absolutely. General line, John? Because a SES, a senior executive service individual, shared this with me, and he said that, you know, for many years he has, as a civilian, retired military, but as a civilian, been involved in meetings of SESs across the government. And they would, you know, be, especially at the beginning of new administrations, I guess, reviewing, or maybe on annual basis, reviewing sort of policy and sharing best practices and so on. And he said, you know, until Donald Trump, he'd never seen anything quite like what he did see at the beginning of that administration, which was people inside the permanent bureaucracy at the highest levels, as you were, essentially saying, we are not going to execute the orders and policy directives of this administration. We're just not going to do it. So, I mean, it's a firsthand account of the general problem that you're talking about here. But it's one thing if it's just slow rolling or impeding, but it's another if it's actively subverting, or worse yet, trying to have a coup d'etat effectively against the government. And you're talking about help from the outside, these nonprofits that facilitate that kind of work in partnership with people on the inside. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and also another very important story was one time in 2017, when I was still in office, we were having a small group call out of the Department of Defense on voting with the White House representative. And that was, I think it was Chris Kobach who was leading that. They put him on mute and essentially laughed at him. What was really shameful, though, there was a Trump appointee in the room who did that. And it's like, and basically the group consensus was, we're going to totally blow this off and not do it. I mean, I was so outraged and furious with that. And especially when there was a Trump appointee right there in the room doing it. So,
Well, it says a lot about the importance of personnel, doesn't it? Personnel is policy, is the old Reagan line used. And to the extent that you wind up, as I think we did under Donald Trump, coming in as he did without essentially a legion of, you know, people in whom he could rightly have confidence to run the 4,000 or so jobs are called the plum book jobs, political appointments, he was at the mercy of this administrative state, the unlawful branches of this government, as you describe them, John. And when we come back, last break at hand here, I do want to just ask you, given all that you've described here, given the very, very dangerous institutionalization of all of this, is there hope for our country? We'll ask that question on the other side of this break. Stay tuned. We're back for the final installment of this extraordinarily important conversation on the occasion of the publication of a new book by our friend and colleague, John Mills, Colonel, United States Army, retired. Also a man who served in senior positions in the senior executive service of what one might call the administrative state. He, however, was a patriot through and through, and what he saw there and what he is warning us all about that's going on now is the stuff that we are, well, to consider required reading. It's all contained in his new book, The Deep State, in which he talks about three unlawful branches of government and the damage that they're doing. John, I put to you before the break the question, have we gotten to such a point where between the administrative state, between the FBI, the IC, the intelligence community, big tech, one might throw in big pharma for good measure, and of course, these nonprofit organizations that you're warning about, where we're so far down the tubes that there's really no hope for corrective action and getting our country back, having it run by just the three lawful branches pursuant to our Constitution. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm always an optimist on these matters, both Reagan and Churchillian and Trumpian. Never, ever surrender, ever, ever, ever surrender. There's a pony somewhere in this pile, and we must never give up. This is the most incredible form of governance that's ever been created. Or paraphrasing Churchill, it's the worst form of government except for all others. So I think, but it takes black belts at the national level to fight the battle, but it takes patriots to get involved at the local level. And this is really a charge to most of the population, need to really, really make sure they have a clean county in all forms of governance. Mm. That's where
this was, of course, the subject of your previous book, The Nation Will Follow. Develop that theme a bit more, if you would.
Yeah, that's the highest priority for 97% of the citizens is ensure you have clean government at the school board, at the county council, at the election board, at the registrar, at the sheriff's, judges, and prosecutors. They may have slightly different titles, slightly different roles and missions, but those are the seven common forms of governance across all 3,300 counties. So we got to make it happen. Right now, it's all about Maricopa, Fulton, and Philadelphia. We got to change the dynamic. And we can help from the outside, but it really depends on citizens in those counties, or at least in the other counties being to outvote that county in that state. But you got to have clean governance, and that's the problem. So hold your officials accountable.
You mentioned three counties, very important in three swing states. There are a couple of others as well, as you know so well, John. And we won't have time to do justice to this topic, but one of the very insidious problems, as you know so well, and you've been working to counter in your own county in Fairfax here in Virginia, you have talked about election integrity and how you can enforce that, especially when there are problems with the machines, there are problems with voter IDs, there are problems with the rolls, there are problems with other mechanisms of election. But also, John, going back to your big tech point, Dr. Robert Epstein is warning about Google being able to influence the elections in a manner that surpasses all of that other stuff. These are hard problems. Is the local work at the county sufficient unto the day?
Well, there's a local fight, there's a national fight, but I think aroused citizens at the local level asking, understanding their state election law and just relentlessly asking reasonable questions and asserting matters at these seven different venues is all important, because even if you have clean officials, they'll it'll force them to reread those laws, because don't ever presume that an official has these laws. And anytime an official says, oh, I have that law memorized. Oh, really? Don't ever take that as an answer. But if you have a dirty county, they are really going to start trying to figure out how to game the system even more. So you relentlessly, but don't commit unforced errors. Don't make angry, violent accusations. Don't make criminal accusations until you have the tapes and the receipts. Okay, so be careful about that. But ask questions over. Just be Columbo. Keep on it. You're about to walk out the door. You turn around. One more question. Then you're about to walk out the door. You turn around. Just one more question. You got to do this over and over and over again. And they will know that you're paying attention. So most recently at my election board, I just asked for the resignation of everybody on the three-person election board. And I have 10 very good reasons why. And so I did that. I think it kind of shocked everybody at the most recent public meeting when I did that. I'd already in private asked for their resignation. It's a Republican board, but they've essentially become a captured opposition of the registrar. Virginia Election Code, the board is supposed to tell the registrar what to do, not the other way around, which is what happens 99.9% of the time in Virginia or anywhere.
So your most important recommendation is know how it's supposed to work, become a very persistent critic where you find it's not working the way it's supposed to, and hold accountable those whose responsibility it is to make sure that it does work properly. Yeah. And John, look, I just think what you've done here in terms of shedding light on the various aspects of a system that has, well, to use your expression, left the rails, is of surpassing importance. And I want to thank you for this book, The Deep State.
War Against Origins, the Deep State.
Excuse me, War Against the Deep State. I've mistaken that several times now, John. I beg your pardon. The War Against the Deep State, critically important adjustment. The Origins of the Mass Surveillance State and the Three Unlawful Branches of the U.S. government. God bless you, my friend. Keep up the good work. Keep coming back to us with more. We'll see you next time.
Thank you,
all
Frank.
All of you as well. God bless you, and go forth and multiply.